This is the last of five sessions looking at the Gospel of Mark. And we're doing it largely on the basis of this book, Mark, a Story, by David Rhodes and Ronald Michie. They are professors at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Rhodes is a New Testament scholar, and Michie teaches literature. And they banded together to teach the class there, looking at the Gospel of Mark as a narrative, as a story. How would you look at it just as a story? And they got some interesting responses to it, and it came out in a book. I've been intrigued by the book, and especially also by the translation of the Gospel of Mark. And I had been teaching the book for some time, and then last year, David Rhodes came here himself and taught it, and he knows the Gospel of Mark from memory. So he just recited it. That led me to be brave enough to read it. So what we're doing this week is, at the beginning of the session, just reading the story, listening to it. So that's what we'll do to begin. Then we'll seek your responses to that. So we ask you, preferably, don't follow it in a text. Just listen to it, because that's the way it came when the story was told originally. Just lean back and let somebody tell you the story. So, we will do that. We're in that section of the story where Jesus is now, after being up in the Galilee for a long time, has moved down and has entered into Jerusalem. And when we were reading last time, he was in the temple and just watching the people put money into the treasury. And then the widow, poor widow, came in and put in two little coppers. And then Jesus said to her, everyone else put in from their surplus, but this woman from her need put in everything she had, her whole living. And then as he was coming out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, teacher, look, what stones and what buildings. And Jesus said to him, you see these great buildings? Definitely not. A stone will be left upon a stone here, which will not definitely be pulled down. And while he was sitting on the mountain overlooking the city, facing the temple, Peter and James and John said to him, tell us when these things will be. What will the sign be when these things are about to be brought to an end? And Jesus began to tell them, look out that no one mislead you. Many will come in my name saying, I am, and mislead many. Now when you hear of battles and reports of battles, don't be alarmed. It's necessary for these things to happen. But it's not yet the end, for nation will rise against nation and realm against realm. There will be earthquakes in different places. There will be famines. These are the beginning of birth pains. Now you look out for yourself. They will hand you over to Sanhedrins, and you will be beaten in synagogues. And you will stand before governors and kings for me to test in testimony to them. But it's necessary first for the good news to be proclaimed among all the Gentile nations. And when they lead you away, handing you over, don't be anxious about what you are to say. Instead, say whatever is given to you in the hour, for you won't be the one speaking, but the Holy Spirit. And brother will hand over brother to death, and father, the child. Children rise in rebellion against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by everyone because of my name. But whoever endures to the end will be saved. Now when you see these horrors of desolation standing where it's necessary that it not stand, let the reader comprehend. At that time, those in Judea are to flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the roof to come down without entering to take something from his house. And whoever is in the field is not to turn back to take his cloak. How awful for those who are pregnant and those nursing a child in those days. Pray that it not happen in winter. For those days will be an oppression, the like of which hasn't happened since the beginning of creation, which God created until now, and definitely won't happen again. And if the Lord had not cut short the days, no flesh would be saved at all. But because of the chosen ones whom he chose, he cut short the days. And at that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the anointed one. Look, there he is. Don't put faith in it. For false anointed ones and false prophets will rise up and give signs and portents to lead astray, if possible, even the chosen ones. But you look out. I've told you everything ahead. However, in those days, after that oppression, the sun will be darkened, and the moon won't give its light, and the stars will be falling from the heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And at that time, people will behold the Son of Man coming in clouds with tremendous power and glory. And at that time, he will send the angels and gather together the chosen ones from the four winds, from the extremity of earth to the extremity of heaven. Not from the fig tree, learn a lesson. When already its shoots have become tender and it's putting out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also you, when you see these things happens, you are to know that he is near, at the doors. I swear to you that this generation will definitely not pass away before all these things happen. The heaven and the earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Now about that day or the hour, no one knows. Either the angels in heaven or the Son, except the Father. Look out, stay awake, for you don't know when the right time will be. It's like a man away, leaving his house and giving his slaves the authority to each his work. He ordered also the doorkeeper to keep watch. So keep watch, for you don't know when the Lord of the house is coming. Whether in the evening or in the middle of the night or at the rooster crow or early in the morning. Otherwise he might come unexpectedly and find you sleeping. Now what I say to you, I'm saying to everyone. Keep watch. Now the Passover festival and the festival of unleavened bread were only 2 days away. And the high priests and the legal experts were seeking how to seize him by deceit and put him to death. For they were saying, not among the festival crowd, otherwise there would be a disturbance of the populace. Jesus was in Bethania, in the house of Simon the leper. While he was reclining to eat, a woman who had an alabaster flask of very expensive, pure nard ointment came in and breaking up the alabaster flask, she began pouring ointment on his head. Now some were angry among themselves. Why has this ointment been wasted? For this ointment could have been sold for over 300 denarii and money given to the poor. And they were harsh with her. Jesus said, let her be. Why are you giving her trouble? It's a good work she did for me. For the poor you always have with you, and whenever you want, you're able to do good for them. But me you will not always have. What she was able to do, she did. She anointed my body ahead for the burial. I swear to you, wherever good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she did will also be told as a remembrance of her. Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went off to the high priest to hand Jesus over to them. And when they heard, they rejoiced and promised to give him silver. And again, he began seeking how at some opportunity he might hand him over. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, when it was customary to slaughter the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, where do you want us to go off and prepare for you to eat the Passover meal? And he sent two of the disciples and said to them, go to the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him, and where he enters into the house, tell the master of the house, the teacher says, where is my guest room where I am to eat Passover meal with my disciples? And he will show you a large upstairs room, furnished and ready. There prepare the meal for us. And the disciples went and did, and came to the city and found things just as he told them, and prepared the Passover meal. And when it was evening, he came with the 12.
While they were reclining and eating, Jesus said, "I swear to you that one of you will hand me over, one eating with me." They began to be sad. To say to him one after another, "Surely not I." He said to them, "One of the 12, the one dipping bread with me in the bowl. The Son of Man goes just as is written about him, but how awful for that man by whom the Son of Man is handed over. Better for that man he had not been born." And while they were eating, he took bread, blessed it, broke it, then gave it to them, saying, take it, this is my body." And taking a cup offering thanks, he gave it to them, and everyone drank from it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is about to be poured out for many. I swear to you that I definitely won't any longer drink from the produce of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the rule of God." And after singing a psalm, they went to the Mountain of Olives. And Jesus said to them, "You will all stumble, because it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, the sheep will be scattered.' However, after I am raised, I'll go ahead of you into Galilee." And Peter said to him, "Even if everyone else stumbles, surely I won't." Jesus said to him, "I swear to you today, this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will renounce me 3 times. But he kept saying, "Well, even if it's necessary for me to die for you, I'll definitely not renounce you." And everyone else was saying the same. They came to a place which had the name Gethsemane. And he said to the disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took along Peter and James and John with him, and he began to be alarmed and anguished. And he said to them, "My life is profoundly sad to death. Stay here and keep watch." And going ahead a little, he fell to the ground and began praying that if it were possible, the hour might pass away from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup away from me, yet not what I want, but what you want." And he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "Simon, are you sleeping? Weren't you strong enough to keep watch 1 hour? Keep watch and pray that you don't come to a testing. The spirit is eager, but the flesh weak." And again, going off, he prayed, saying the same words. And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, "Are you going to sleep through and keep resting? It's over. The hour's come. Look, the Son of Man is about to be handed over to the hands of the sinners. Rise, let's go. Look, the one handing me over has come near." And immediately, while he was still talking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the high priests and the legal experts and the elders. Now the one handing him over had given them a signal, saying, "He is the one I'll kiss. Seize him and lead him away under security." And coming, immediately approaching him, he said, "Rabbi," and kissed him dramatically. And they put hands on him and seized him. But one of those standing by drew his sword, struck the slave of the high priest, and cut off a little piece of his ear. And reacting, Jesus said to them, "As against a bandit did you come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was among you in the temple teaching, and you didn't seize me. However, so the writings might be fulfilled." And leaving Jesus, everyone fled. And a certain young man was following him, wearing a linen cloth around his naked body, and they seized him. But leaving the linen cloth behind, he fled, naked. They led Jesus away to the high priest. And all the high priests and the elders and the legal experts assembled, and Peter followed him from a distance on the inside to the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting together with the guards and warming himself in the firelight. Now the high priest and the whole Sanhedrin were seeking testimony against Jesus to have him put to death.
But they were not finding any, for there were many testifying falsely against him, but their testimony would not agree. And some rose and testified falsely against him, saying, "We ourselves heard him say, I will pull down the sanctuary made with hands, and in 3 days build another not made with hands." But not even on this point did their testimony agree. And rising to the center, the high priest asked Jesus, saying, "Aren't you answering anything at all? What are these men testifying against you?" But he kept quiet and did not answer anything at all. And again the high priest asked him and said to him, "Are you the anointed one, the one of the blessed one?" Jesus said, "I am, and you will behold the Son of Man sitting on the right of the powerful one and coming with the clouds of heaven." And the high priest, tearing his vestments, said, "What further need have we of witnesses? You heard the blasphemy. How does it appear to you?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. And some began to spit on him and cover his face. They hit him and say to him, "Prophesy." And the guards took to beating him. Peter was down in the courtyard. When one of the maids of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked intently at him and said, "You too were with the Nazarene Jesus." But he denied it, saying, "I don't know or understand what you're talking about." And he went outside to the forecourt, and a rooster crowed. And the maid saw him and began again to say to those standing by, "He's one of them." But again he denied it. And after a little while, those standing by began saying to Peter, "Truthfully, you're one of them. For you two are a Galilean." And immediately he began to put himself under a curse, to swear, "No, I don't know this man that you're talking about." And the second time, a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying, how Jesus had said to him, "Behold, a rooster crows before a rooster crows twice, you will renounce me three times." And lurching off, he began sobbing. Immediately early in the morning, the high priest held a council with the elders and legal experts and the whole Sanhedrin, and they bound Jesus, took him away, and handed him over to Pilate. And Pilate said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And answering him said, "You are saying so." And the high priest were bringing many charges against him, and Pilate asked him again, saying, "Aren't you answering anything at all? Look how many charges they're bringing against you." But Jesus no longer answered anything at all, with the result that Pilate was amazed. Now at festivals, he would release for them one prisoner whom they requested. Now the one called Barabbas was bound in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. And coming up, the crowd began to ask, "Do for us what you customarily do at this time." And Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he knew that on account of envy the high priest had handed him over. But the high priest stirred up the crowd to have him instead release Barabbas to them. And Pilate spoke up again and said, "What should I do with the king of the Jews?" And they screamed back, "Crucify him!" Pilate said, "Why? What harm has he done?" But they screamed all out, "Crucify him!" Now Pilate, wishing to do a satisfactory thing for the crowd, released to them Barabbas, and whipping Jesus, handed him over to be crucified. Now the soldiers led him away into the courtyard, which is a praetorium, and they called together the whole cohort, and they put a purple cloak on him, and they set him on him a crown of woven from thorns, and they began to greet him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were beating his head with a reed pole and spitting on him and getting down on their knees. They were giving him obeisance. And when they had mocked him, they took the purple cloak off him, put his own clothes on him, and then led him out to crucify him. And they drafted a passerby, a certain Simon Cyrene, coming from the countryside, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to take up his cross. And they brought Jesus to the place Golgotha, which means place of the skull.
And they tried giving him wine drugged with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him. And they divided up his clothes, casting lots for them, who might take what. And it was 9 a.m. when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him was inscribed, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified 2 bandits, one on the right and one on his left. And those going by were blaspheming him, wagging their heads and saying, "Ah! The one who's going to pull down the sanctuary and build one in 3 days, save yourself by getting down off the cross." Likewise, also the high priests mocking him to each other with the legal experts were saying, "Others are restored, himself he's unable to save. Let the anointed one, the King of Israel, get down off the cross so we might see and have faith." And even those crucified along with him were ridiculing. And when it was noon, a darkness came over the whole land until 3. And at 3, Jesus shouted in a loud cry, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you abandoned me?" And some of those standing by heard it and said, "Look, he's calling Elijah." And someone ran, filled a sponge with cheap wine, put it on a reed pole, and offered him a drink, saying, "Let him be. Let's see if Elijah comes to get him down." But Jesus, letting out a loud cry, died. And the curtain of the sanctuary was ripped in 2 from top to bottom. Now when the centurion, who was standing in front of him, saw that he died like this, he said, "Truthfully, this man was a son of God." Now there were also women observing from a distance, among them Mary the Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James the Lesser, and Joses, and Salome, who were following him and serving him when he was in Galilee, and many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. It was already evening, and since it was preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph from Arimathea, a prominent council member who also was himself expecting the rule of God, came and, taking courage, went into Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Now Pilate was amazed that he had already died, and summoning the centurion, he asked him whether he had been dead long. And finding out from the centurion, he granted the corpse to Joseph. And buying a linen cloth, taking him down, Joseph wrapped him in the linen cloth and put him in a grave which had been hewn out of rock, then rolled a stone up against the door of the grave. Now Mary the Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joses were observing where he had been put. When the Sabbath passed, Mary the Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome brought an aromatic oil so they may go anoint him. And very early in the morning, on the first day after the Sabbath, they went toward the grave as the sun came up. And they were saying to themselves, "Who will roll away for us the stone from the door of the grave?" And looking up, they observed that the stone had been rolled away, for it was large. And entering into the grave, they saw a young man sitting to the right, wearing a white robe. And they were alarmed. He said to them, "Don't be alarmed. You're seeking Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He was raised. He's not here. Look, the place where they put him. But go tell his disciples, even Peter, he's going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will behold him, just as he told you." But coming out, they fled from the grave, for they were trembling and stunned. And they said nothing to anyone at all. As we've done each morning, I'd like to ask you to take about 2 minutes and just turn to anyone right near you there and share some of your reactions. What did you notice? What did you miss? Or how did you feel? Anything at all about the story that you just heard. Would you do that just for... Well, we'd like to do...
What we'd like to do is spend a little time asking you to share with the rest of us what you notice and maybe get some exchange back and forth going. And then also, just as I'll try to slip in some references from the chapters in this book, which look at various aspects of the story. For those of you who weren't here, it looks at the rhetoric that's used in the story. It looks at the settings, the geography of the story. It looks at the plot as the plot develops and conflict develops. And it looks at the characters that are in it, the various characters, how they're revealed and portrayed, and then it looks at what was the expected or outcome of having the story told or listening to the story. So we'll try to slip that in. But let's go back to where you were and ask what was it that you noticed or that you commented about or you exchanged about or any comments you want.
Elmer?
Yes.
Found that you spend so much time reading the word or studying the word.
Yes.
I was, you got more familiar today than previously, so it worked to listen a lot more, but I was impressed again with it in Mark, the utter loneliness of Jesus. At the beginning of the gospel was declared Son of God, and at the end, I guess, was affirmed too, but only by a Roman centurion, otherwise he was absolutely alone.
And the only line from the cross that Mark chooses to record is, "Why have you abandoned me?"
Yeah. And then the ending that Mark chooses to share with us, this very human, but it's not the ending best I like to read about that story, of the people keeping quiet because they're afraid. That's so sad.
It seems to me that's the genius of Mark, though. He leaves it hanging there, and we have to finish it.
Yeah.
You said the people keeping quiet. I guess the thing I was struck with is that they're women. And the other part of it was, the front part of that is who was left around the cross. Mm-hmm. Just the women followers and John. And then, you know, they're the ones that are doing the grieving and sorrowing. And the disciples have left. And I was really struck by that this time for some reason. And then who is left to go do the anointing, and sure, that was a traditional women's thing to do, I guess, at that time, to go do the anointing. But then I just felt a great sadness this time hearing that they knew, because of who they were as women, that they couldn't tell this because it wouldn't be believed. And I just, you know, when I heard that, and then they were afraid, it just seemed like such a tragedy that there they were, the ones that stuck around, the time, you know, that were there with him during his time of suffering. And yet during the moment of real glory, could not share that because of their situation.
Yeah, and in Mark's gospel, John's not there.
Yeah,
it's all women.
Yeah, it's all women.
Again, that's what the writers of this book say. Yeah, just for a while, stick in John's Mark's gospel. Just take this one and see what that impact is. Don't bring in all the other stuff. And this one, it's the women. Trust them.
We talked a little bit up here about often when I've heard the story, want to identify with the disciples or the believers.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid that if the situation happened today, probably a part of the crowd looking at it all happening and then criticizing the disciples for, they're making this all up and they're cranking this whole myth about the resurrection, backing off and not getting involved.
I was struck by when Jesus tries the image that I picked it up from John, to speak with John, but it never struck me as much in Mark. When Jesus uses an image of trying to understand all of this and all the conflagration and tribulation later on, uses the image of birth pangs.
Mm-hmm.
That just leaped out at me like flash. I've never really seen it there. That if, and his understanding, trying to understand all of it, understands it as a birth. And the grandeur and the power of that had never quite come to me as it had this time.
He also talks about sympathizing or saying how sad for those who are pregnant or who are nursing at this time. Now, why, you know, how many men would have that come to mind, you know, have that kind of empathy with a pregnant woman or nursing? I also have just started learning a little bit about liberation theology, and I thought during this, how would someone, say, in a South American country where people are being tortured for trying to improve the lot of the poor, how much they must identify with the thought of Jesus being tortured in this oppressive government, the guards spitting on him and torturing him. What, from their point of view, what that means, if you read the story.
It really struck me how Mark underplays the resurrection. He affirms it, but almost in a whisper.
Yeah, the writers of the books and contention, you've probably heard me say it during the week, is it's really a passion story with a long introduction, and the point of the telling of this passion story is will anybody go to Galilee? And someone in the early session said, she felt so, adverb she used, terribly, terribly sad at all this stuff that had happened. And, their ending for her was a real sad one. And the only, I think, the amazing part of it is that anybody showed in Galilee. And of course, you were implying that you hear the story and you have to answer for yourself. Would you go? Or as Rich was implying, I probably wouldn't. I'd have gone home, cook some egg cock.
Well, I had fun getting hung up in the early part that you were reading about the latter days that Jesus is talking about. And so my head spent a little time thinking about the Jehovah's Witnesses that come to my door from time to time and conversations I have with them, because I really enjoy talking to them and trying to tell them why I don't think what they were talking about is very important. And then here Jesus is saying all these things that sound important, and I was kind of uneasy until you got to the verse that reminded me, but what's really important is just watch and live. And I thought, oh good, that's what I've been telling them.
Listen, they're due at my house soon. Will you come home?
You might have a whole vocation here. Yes, please.
You started setting up, I guess, Monday when you mentioned the connection was ripped open.
Yeah.
The heavens ripped open for the baptism. Mm-hmm. And then the temple curtain ripped open, and the other one somewhere in the middle. The old wineskins will rip open if the new wine is in them. I never had connected it before this morning, but like the wineskins were ripping when that temple curtain.
Right.
The old stuff was spilling out of the old stuff.
Yeah. Rhodes and Ritchie would say that those words are, at least in a storyteller's mind and whoever else's mind, were purposely put in to keep that connection. There would be the same feeling. The feelings would be repeated. Right? The rhetoric seems to be very carefully done in the document that we get. Whether that was just, the period of time it gets refined and as it gets told again and again, or whether there was just really a good mark, whoever it was, told the story. That's the one that they all liked and remembered because it did those things. Yeah.
What puzzled me was from other accounts, he leaves the story with Pilate not knowing what had happened, with all these things obviously happening.
Yeah.
He reports it as Pilate didn't know he'd died.
Right.
And that struck me.
Mm-hmm. In the section on characters, in their book, they talk about Jesus as the dominant character, and then the disciples, of course, and then the opponents, of course. And then the last section is on the walk-on parts. And Pilate plays almost a walk-on part here. He's got a couple of lines, but not very much. Some of them, excuse me, the walk-on parts, no, like Simon of Cyrene and Joseph of Arimathea, they're doing the things that you would hope the disciples would do. And they just come in, do their little bit, make it look good, and almost make it look easy, and walk off. And disciples sit there, blah, you know, understanding what it's all about. So, you're right, Pilate is treated quite differently by Mark.
Pilate has a big caseload. Yeah. And it's a bunch of statistics.
Yeah. Right.
The interesting part of the reading, Elmer, that I think you might have missed was to watch the interpreter.
Oh, yeah.
When you're, especially when you're talking about the women and their anguish and their emotional reactions to all this. You can see it all in her.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a vivid, living kind of expression of what you were reading to us. I suggest that someone like that always be by yourself.
That's good. But what will her husband John say?
That's his problem.
When I was in New York at continuing education last October at Union Seminary, picking up on the women in the story, Phyllis Trible, who is certainly a bright contemporary theologian, was doing things about the feminist traditions that have, in her opinion, been eradicated. She thinks there's the Mosaic tradition of Moses is certainly the very strong one, but she believes there was also a Miriamnic tradition, and just uses the little pieces of it that are she feels are left in the stories, and tries to make a very very strong case. She talked for, I think, for an hour and three quarters straight. We all sat there and just listened and pretty entranced. So that, and her contention was that there were these other well-developed feminist traditions that were systematically, carefully eradicated by the male domination over the, not only decades but centuries, and that there are some the surprise we have, or at least that I have, I was sharing with our worker here, that we had, that all of a sudden they pop up. Here's a whole gang of women that who were probably around during all of it. Way at the end, you get some names and everything else. That's almost a surprise, and maybe that surprise is because they were edited out of the script. I thought it was clever of Phyllis Trible, who's certainly not only bright but clever as well, that in comparing the Mosaic tradition and the tradition of Moses and Miriam, and she said, all you have to do is you have to take all these little parts and try to put them together and from Miriam, but they also form a mosaic. That was clever, clever twist. interesting presentation. Yep.
It's just neat that we're going to go home with words like riddles instead of parables, and Peter wept not bitterly but dramatically, and the young man lurching ran away. Those are just kind of little souvenirs of listening to another man's lips. They're just kind of refreshing and kind of neat and picture it in just a little bit different way.
And then we're going home with some ways to say it with our hands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are two things I would like to add. One is, I like your sharing that about Phyllis, because when I was signing it and I spelled the story of Mary, no, the story of Mark. Maybe Phyllis and I should talk. The other thing was that it's really interesting. Not only do I end up with the question of who's going to Galilee, I end up with the question emphasized by the fact that this story says the disciples are really awkward, blundering oafs who really don't understand much of anything. And even at the end, they're not where they are supposed to be, or I would feel they should be, okay? And so it's like, as a disciple that I have, you know, professed myself to be, what am I doing right, if anything? And am I going to Galilee? So it's really becomes a much deeper question for myself.
Jesus didn't expect them to be right until they received the Holy Spirit. They expected them to be weak. They weren't empowered yet.
I'm afraid, I think the Gospel stuff with Mark didn't show Jesus had a lot of expectations. He bawled them out when they didn't. You don't believe yet? How come? You don't understand this riddle? How would he get the rest? And so whether his expectations were really, you know, looking at the overall, that the Holy Spirit would do it, the Gospel of Mark sure put some heavy trips on the disciples. In contrast to some of the other Gospels, Luke treats them much better, treats the disciples much better. But Mark, they get pretty much short shrift.
Just the thing there, Paul Olson yesterday was reading from J.D. Salinger, I think it was Catcher in the Rye, where a kid was reacting, Jesus is great, you know, he's really intelligent, most intelligent guy, more than Moses, more than, who else would have intelligence enough to be in Pilate's court and be still? But the disciples, I can't, like, you know, they just seem so dense and so dumb. And he's talking about a friend of mine used to try to talk me out of that. But, you say, well, Jesus picked them, didn't he? And they say, yeah, but at random?
That's good.
Maybe the Holy Spirit was an afterthought to trying to resurrect all the bungling things in the These guys need a booster shot.
You see them having a committee meeting decide this thing isn't going the way we liked it. What are we going to do? Yes.
Let's do another ad.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of ambiguous, though, about you said that you had high expectations. I did. But he also told us that if you had any faith at all, you could move this mountain.
Sure.
So it's pretty clear that he doesn't believe that we have any faith, because we can't even move a hill. And that what strikes me about that one specific example is that the whole story is full of this ambiguity and uncertainty. And that's part of why I like the story, hearing it all together. Important part of it. It's not black and white.
For sure. Yes.
Sometime during Lent, we were watching one of those TV movies about the Bible, and you know, you always have to kind of wade through those. But one of the things that the script was doing is sort of introducing you to the disciples before Jesus got there. And we found ourselves sitting there hearing Peter being high-headed about the fish and the nets and stuff. You said you just said to yourself, oh, don't pick him. Look at his temper. If you had been making judgments on the disciples, then Jesus would come in and pick me and go, oh, bad move. You know, that was pretty much just Hollywood. We probably wouldn't have picked the same men that Jesus did.
Who'd invite Martin Luther to be a pastor in your church? If you know Martin Luther, you'd be in trouble from the first go. Drinks too much in the first place. Marty says, well, he's the only guy whose comments while he was drinking after dinner were written down as spiritual journeys. Really sort of weird. So you're right. I mean, it's all the way been the way wrong, and I think that's what we were saying here too. That here we are, the blundering oafs today. Yeah.
Oh, when you were reading today, I guess I'm a procrastinator, and today it brought it up closer. Thinking of the end times, I think of, well, this is the way it will be in the end times. But talking about a generation, how does that happen? And I was thinking today, at the end, when the endurance lasts until that time, I had to think of Bonhoeffer.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, this was enduring to the end, and this was his generation, and it is something for us to look at. There will be someone in our generation that will be an example for us.
I saw the, I heard the talk on South Africa, and they talked about the women and the children, tens of thousands who were killed during the takeover of South Africa. And for them, they endured until the end. And it gave me a new appreciation of how in this generation, whether it's personal or in some other way, how we have to look at it and should look at it through our own eyes, not through the media's eyes, to the end.
Good, yeah, I really agree. And adding to that, so Central America and that, and then also the people of the parish that I belong to in Chicago, who's, you know, black parish, that the children had no hope of ever having a job. The women, the mothers said, if your child grows up to age 7, if you get your daughter to age 7 before being raped, you've done, been a good parent. So the end is pretty close to me. Yep.
I would like to find out something dramatic and up to date about the words of Jesus that we heard. They went by rather swiftly. But my point is that Jesus said something that modern science will just nod and be in perfect agreement with. And you could have astronomers and cosmologists and nuclear physicists listen to those words, heaven and earth shall pass away. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, yes, we are understanding this strange arrangement of the cosmos. And they would hear him say that, and it would be so perfectly intellectually up to date to be able to say that, inasmuch as Jesus said, God is a spirit. And the difference between the material world and the spiritual world is so vast that he's right there with the modern scientists saying that the material world is a strange, here it is, and then it's gone, but the spiritual will survive.
Thank you. Yeah, Larry.
I know that we're commonly astounded that Jesus stood silently when he was accused, but legally he was doing exactly what he was supposed to do. He was falsely accused, there were no witnesses that could agree. Under those circumstances, you're not supposed to say a thing, you just stand silent. But he was doing what he was supposed to do.
The system should have exonerated him, but of course it was the system that was messed up.
Could I add just a little bit of information?
Sure.
I teach Renaissance art history course, and in all the paintings of the Adoration of the Magi, the event takes place in a little shack, and the little shack is surrounded by ruins of Roman architecture. I don't know, maybe you all know that, but it underlines this, the theme of, I will tear down the temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. So all of our creches and our Christmas scenes are always in some little temporary Sierra design building in the midst of some great colossal piece of stone architecture. When you get your next Christmas card, remember that.
Do you think that in our churches we all have the inserts with the scriptures for the day in there, and everybody faithfully plucks it out and looks at it while it's being read? And it was so meaningful to just listen today. Do you think it would be more meaningful if we could encourage our home congregations to listen?
Yeah, I do. We stopped getting them here. We were getting those, and we just stopped getting them. Because first of all, we wanted to be able to choose whatever translation made sense for it. Some translations are better in the Old Testament than new, and some books of the Bible are better translated elsewhere, so we could be selective. But then also, well, the second step is to get people who will work at reading it. And then the third is that I don't think we really need to have stuff in front of us. And it is somehow the contact with the people, which, you know, was what was happening here, the pull of her activity to her person was, well, that's why it's good communication. Now, I surely think Rich Kemmerer's dad taught us a lot about reading, and whether we do it well or not, but his emphasis on the way it's read was a great deal part of learning to homiletics and communicate. Reading the scriptures was just an important thing to know how to do. And we have people come up. Ruth Schultz comes up here from Seattle and has classes in how to read. Obviously, all for the clergy, of course, but also for the people who would be reading as lay readers.
Are the authors of this book doing the other parts of the gospel, the other gospels?
I heard that they were working on Matthew, but I haven't heard any more than that.
Good, I hope they come through. Beautiful job.
Yeah, I'd like to see that translation come out by itself, you know, so it can be used as a translation to read. You know, it's 27 pages in here. But I think it's really bad. And I, just as you said, the little innuendo, the nuances, and not innuendo, nuances that are in there just are helpful to get a taste of that. I like that. Else? Yes?
I just want to say one word about grace and signing.
Sure.
You were at church last night. For the first time in my life, I felt what it was to not hear, because the instruments were playing and she was signing three different verses of a hymn. And I sort of remember the first verse and maybe a phrase in the second, third, but for the most part, I couldn't hear what she was saying. But all these people in the front row were nodding,
right,
keeping track. And it felt, well, I couldn't hear. It was kind of sad and lonely. And
yeah. We would have to look up that hymn and read it, mm-hmm, while she was doing it. And they were getting the words.
Yeah.
Getting the message. Well, we had a good meeting last night talking about the hearing impaired week, and I think learned some things about what to do to make it even better, and involving more people, so we're looking ahead to next year also. Anyone else?
And the kids.
Pardon?
You said, and the kids.
And the kids.
Right.
He did that in the middle of a sentence, and I noticed it. I had to ask, was that the word for kids? It looked like it. I love her.
Elmer, I think an interesting Bible study back in our own parishes would be to take the text for the upcoming Sunday in a group, mm-hmm, and attempt to rewrite it in this kind of fashion,
sure,
so that then that next Sunday the pastor could read it from it.
Yeah, I think text
sort of a passive act to buy the book and read it.
Uh-huh.
I think it's much more beneficial for us to attempt to learn to rewrite,
right,
those books ourselves.
Yeah, I think this book would help somebody get at that kind of a process if they wanted to do their translation. And I think in a good text study, that's a neat thing to do, especially if you can build people who are going every week. Marty Haugen was here for 10 months as a musician, and he's been doing it for 10 or 12 years in his parish, and he is marvelous at a textual study. Barbara Lundblad, who almost made bishop of the Lutheran Church, will be with us the last week in July. And that's her assignment of the week. She's preaching six Vespers, because quite convinced she'll be the best preacher in the village. There's no sense in wasting her. And then she's going to be leading textual studies and how with people over a period of time, where you won't just get one textual study a week, you get work on six texts with her. So I think that'll be interesting. We'll see what she does with that, too. Well, thanks to you
very
much.
Well.